come back now to our chief purpose, and now we're going to look at Ezekiel 8 to 11. With all the talk about imminent revival and optimism about the future of church growth, a decade of evangelism and so on that's going on at the moment, it is important that we don't lose touch with the realities of what's happening also in our country, which is that every year a few churches die. Churches whose packed congregations once bustled with vitality, churches that bear the names of great and godly pastors on their walls, churches that were once the scene of remarkable revivals. But today, some of them stand like empty barns, the doors kept open on Sundays perhaps by a handful of 80-year-olds. Some are turned into factories and warehouses, some are transformed into temples and mosques for the use of our new immigrant communities. On the free church side, you'll quite often see over the doors of those rather derelict sanctuaries the optimistic names of earlier generations given in their infancy. Ebenezer, the Stone of Help, Bethesda, the House of Mercy, Rehoboth, Broad Places, Providence, Salem, Bethel, Hope, and of course Zion. But a more appropriate name for the old age of many of these churches and chapels, I'm afraid, would be that which the wife of Phinehas gave to her son when she heard that the Ark of the Covenant had been captured by the Philistines. Ichabod, she said, the glory has departed. Why do churches die? Why does the glory sometimes depart from the people of God in that way? Why, indeed, in some parts of the world, like in North Africa and some parts of Asia, have entire Christian civilizations been lost to rival ideologies and religions? Well, I don't say that I'm going to offer you the only reason for that. There are undoubtedly many factors involved in the decline of churches, not the least of which is the inscrutable mystery of God's sovereign purpose. It would be grossly naive, if not a little arrogant, to think that we could rationalize all the vicissitudes of church history in a single address. But there can be no doubt that within the complex web of God's dealings with his people, one reason for the departure of God's blessing from churches is judgment. As Christ warned the church at Ephesus, "You have forsaken your first love. Remember the height from which you have fallen. Repent and do the things you did at first. If you don't, I will remove your lampstand from its place." God is never irrevocably committed to any local shrine, precisely because, as Ezekiel realized, he is not the God of places. He's the God of people. When those people persistently and unrepentantly fail, then no matter how ancient their traditions, no matter how sacred their church buildings, no matter how blessed their past history, Ichabod is the name. The glory will depart. And that is the very literal lesson of these chapters we're going to look at now in Ezekiel, chapters 8 to 11. We see in these chapters, quite literally, the glory of God departing and relocating elsewhere in these chapters. If you like to break the study up into three bits, just to aid your following of it, you can call chapter 8, the glory of God offended, chapter 9, the glory of God avenged, and then finally in verses 10 to 11, the glory of God relocated. In chapters 10 to 11. Look first at the glory of God offended then with me in chapter 8. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day, while I was sitting in my house, and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. Now you remember the scene. Ezekiel is with the Jewish exiles in Babylonia. The year is now 591 BC. And things back in Jerusalem at this time are beginning to hot up. Zedekiah, the puppet king placed on the throne by the emperor Nebuchadnezzar, is under increasing pressure from the populace to rebel against his imperial master and make a bid to restore Judah's national pride, to fulfill all these prophecies of speedy restoration that were circulating. The exiles are getting worried. Disturbing reports are reaching them about unsavory elements taking advantage of the lack of law and order in the city of Jerusalem, perhaps. What's going to happen? How would it affect them? News must have travelled frustratingly slowly across those 500 miles of desert. It's out of date before it arrives. If only we could know what's going on now, they were saying to themselves. But wait a minute, maybe we can. What about paying Ezekiel a call? Oh, I know he's a bit eccentric, but he does come from a good family, you know, and people say he has an uncanny gift of telepathy. Maybe he can get tuned in on Jerusalem and provide us with a kind of up-to-date report of the current situation there. That seems to be the background to this delegation of senior men from the exilic community sitting in front of the prophet, wondering perhaps with a mixture of foreboding and anticipation whether he's going to have one of his odd turns or not. They're not left long in doubt. Verse 2, I looked, and I saw a figure like that of a man. From what appeared to be his waist down, he was like fire, and from there up, his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. You'll immediately catch the affiliation to the earlier vision. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me up by the hair of my head. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem. Now, once again, we mustn't allow the vividness and detail of the commentary that follows to make us forget those last words. In visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem. But this is not, as I think some have supposed, an example of psychic levitation, nor of Star Trek-like conveyance by energy beam. Ezekiel's bodily presence remained firmly planted in Babylonia. It was only in vision, in his prophetic imagination, that he's transported, though not without, it seems, a rather uncomfortable physical sensation of high-speed travel accompanying the experience. He took me by the hairs of my head. But what he sees on arrival is far more hair-raising than the strange manner of his journey. Verse 3, in the entrance at the north gate of the inner court, the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, as in the vision I had seen in the plain. Then he said to me, Son of man, look toward the north. So I looked. And in the entrance north of the gate of the altar, I saw this idol of jealousy. Now, Ezekiel already knew from the chapters that we've omitted in 4 to 7 that it was the issue of idolatry that would prove decisive in Judah's condemnation by God. The exile, he has heard, is a judgment on God, and the judgment isn't finished yet. An even more permanent and final termination of Jerusalem is going to happen. 14 months before, in his initial call, the phrase detestable idols had already been burnt into his mind by constant repetition. But I suspect even he, though prior to this experience he'd realized to some extent that idolatry was the issue, even he had not realized to what extent the idolatrous practices which God was condemning had penetrated Jerusalem itself. Immediately he arrives in this vision, he is confronted by this ominous indicator of it, the idol that provokes to jealousy. Scholars tell us that judging from the rather unusual word Ezekiel uses for idol here, this was probably a replica of the carved wooden Asherah which King Manasseh had erected. You can read about it in 2 Kings earlier. He erected it some 50 years or so before. It was a crude Canaanite fertility symbol. Such images were not new in Israel, of course. The prophets had been denouncing them for centuries. Indeed, Asherah are mentioned as early as the book of Judges. But they were usually associated with the rural peasantry. Here was one, this obelisk of obscenity, which had been set up not just within the capital city, but actually within the temple precincts, and in full view of everyone who came to worship, including, of course, the king, who had regularly used the north gate to pass from his royal palace into the temple area. Ezekiel's observation point is so arranged as to convey the resulting spiritual confrontation with the maximum of intensity. He stands, you see, on the inside of the north gate, looking north through the gate. He sees the idol. Looking south from the gate, he sees, hovering over the inner sanctuary, that same Shekinah glory, that same vision that symbolized God's presence. So no wonder the Spirit calls it the idol of jealousy. Jehovah, the husband of Israel, joined to her by solemn covenant, had demanded her exclusive devotion. Yet here she was, like some brazen hussy, openly making love to another in his own home, indeed in his own direct line of vision, as it were. God could see it going on through the gateway. The confrontation was that direct. It's tempting then to ask what God sees when he looks out through the doors of his churches today into our society. I suppose in many ways the modern equivalent of an Asherah pole would be an adult bookshop, as they're so euphemistically called. They don't have dedicated to Asherah over the door, it's true, but the mystery of sex, which Asherah has personified and idolized, is still worshipped in such institutions. And, of course, increasingly publicly condoned in our society, just as it was being, it seems, publicly condoned in Jerusalem. But that wasn't the worst. Going on from verse 6, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here? Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see things that are even more detestable. Then he brought me to the entrance to the court, and I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of man, now dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and saw a doorway there. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things they are doing here. Now, built into the temple walls were rooms occupied generally by important people in the national administration. Ezekiel is guided, it seems, through a hidden door into what you might have called an inner sanctum, if sanctity had not been so conspicuous by its absence. For the walls of this secret chamber, we're told in verse 10, had been covered with frescoes depicting a veritable menagerie of pagan deities. I went in and looked, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel, and Jaazaniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his own idol? They say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. The worship of animal deities in the ancient world was associated with Egypt. So some commentators wonder if this clandestine gathering didn't have political overtones. Were the Jewish leaders plotting alliance with Babylon's great imperial rival, Egypt? Had they given up on Jehovah and decided to court gods who might prove themselves more sympathetic to Judah's ambitions for a restored independence? Well, that's far from impossible. It would certainly explain the need for secrecy. But I'm tempted to think that this meeting was not quite as sinister as that. You notice verse 12 says, each at the shrine of his own idol. Emphasis on the idiosyncratic nature of this idolatry. This was no political conspiracy, I think. It was much more like a private club where prominent men indulged their personal idolatrous inclinations without risking their public reputations. You find the same thing still today. Sophisticated, well-educated, well-dressed, respectable men obsessed like schoolboys with secret societies. some in their Masonic lodges, some in their vice clubs, some in their black magic covens, and all enjoying the esoteric thrill of tasting forbidden fruit in their exclusive fraternities. And still reassuring themselves, as the elders of Israel, it seems, did, that the Lord doesn't see us here. Yet there's still more, we're told. Verse 13. You will see them doing things that are even more detestable, Ezekiel is told. Then he brought me to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord, and I saw women sitting there, mourning for Tammuz. Usually, you know, it's the women folk who are the last to lose touch with real religion in a society. Perhaps because they have an intuitive feeling, more than men do, about spiritual things, and are less reliant on the observable evidences of God's presence. Perhaps also because motherhood makes them sensitive to the moral welfare of their children, more than men perhaps are. Certainly it is true, when women stop praying, then a society is really in trouble. Tammuz, we're told here, he was a Babylonian god, a handsome youth who, according to legend, died tragically, and who consequently provided the focus for a cult of sentimentality that seems to have been particularly attractive to women at this time. And so Ezekiel sees that tears that should have been shed for the sins of their husbands and children were being squandered on this mythical Adonis. Today, those tears are more likely to be evoked by a Mills Boone romance or a television soap opera, aren't they? But I'm not sure there's any essential difference. Tammuz was really just a fantasy that provided these women with some avenue of emotional release from the tensions and the realities of a rather severe and austere life. And in that respect, it had much in common with the kind of escapist entertainment that performs the same function in our society. Millions in this country participate in the mythical world of Neighbours or EastEnders every week. A few years ago, they were weeping for Bobby Ewing in Dallas. That may very well be just the 20th century equivalent of weeping for Tammuz. But Ezekiel's told there's still more to come, verse 15. Do you see this, son of man? You will see things that are even more detestable than this. Then he brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord. And there at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they were bowing down to the sun in the east. Step by step, God has been bringing Ezekiel's eyes closer and closer to the central sanctuary. First the idol in the outer court, then the secret vault in the temple wall, then the women by the gate. Now his attention is drawn to a group of men who stand on the very threshold of the temple buildings themselves. And the implication, I think, is quite clearly that these were clergy. This spot between the altar and the temple porch was the place where traditionally the priests stood to plead with God for the people's pardon. Joel chapter 2 verse 17, if you want an Old Testament reference to that. Well, these men were standing there all right. But see which way they faced. Toward the east, they worshipped the sun. They had quite literally turned their backs on God. So the clergy themselves were implicated in this horrendous slide towards national apostasy. And we must ask ourselves whether countless church leaders in our day haven't done just the same. Abandoned the exclusive claims of Christ for so-called dialogue with other faiths. Surrendered the authority of a trustworthy gospel in order to espouse the cause of rationalism and the so-called scientific study of the Bible. Every year that passes, we see men who deny the deity of Christ or the authority of Scripture ordained to the Christian ministry or even promoted to bishops' thrones or to chairs of theology. Men who have publicly turned their back on the temple and yet retain office within the temple. God puts the question to us that he puts to Ezekiel, surely, about that. Verse 17, have you seen this, son of man? Is it a trivial matter? Is it a trivial matter for the house of Judah to do the detestable things they are doing here? Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger? Look at them putting the branch to their nose, he says. So God summarizes this chapter. Is it trivial that sexual promiscuity is publicly condoned? Is it trivial that the nation's leadership indulge in occult vice? Is it trivial that the emotions of the populace are prostituted on escapist fantasies? Is it trivial that church leaders no longer believe the Apostles' Creed? How does God be assured if it seems trivial to us, it does not to God? To him, all these things are an unendurable provocation, and the spiritual route, from which the moral anarchy, the slide towards violence, and hooliganism, and everything else that we dislike in our society, is flowing. These detestable practices, he says, offend his glory. And that's probably the meaning of this rather difficult phrase in verse 17, about the branch to the nose. Some suggest this is some mysterious pagan rite, but I suspect those interpreters are nearer the mark, who interpret the Hebrew rather as meaning, they are a stench in my nose. The glory of God dwells in the temple, or at least it should do. Yet all around it, and even within it, lies the evidence of the nation's unfaithfulness. And is it any wonder then that God is repelled by all this? Is it any wonder the offended glory feels like leaving home? You see, he's already put that on the agenda in verse 6. They are doing things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. So when we ask why churches are dying, why has the spiritual health of our land ebbed away? Why are the people of God in exile feeling marginalized? Well, here at least is one possible explanation. That the glory of God is a sensitive guest in any culture. And that brings us to chapter 9, the glory of God avenged. Then I heard him call out in a loud voice, "Bring the guards of the city here, each with a weapon in his hand." And I saw six men coming from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen who had a writing kit at his side. And they came in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now, it's obvious these are not human soldiers. These are seven archangels whose normal function is to defend God's people. But they're taken from their normal duty on the city walls, where they're stationed to protect Zion, and they're given new orders. No longer are they commissioned to protect Jerusalem, rather it is their duty now to execute judgment on it. And that's what goes on to happen in chapters 9 and 10. First with the slaughter of the idolaters in chapter 9, and then the destruction of the city itself with holy fire in chapter 10. It's worth noting four things, I think, about the passage. First, the special protection which is afforded to the godly in the city. See that in verse 3. Now the glory of the God of Israel went up from above the cherubim where it had been. And the Lord called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing kit at his side, and he said, "Go throughout the city of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in it." As I listened, he said to the others, "Follow him through the city and kill without showing pity or compassion. Slaughter old men, young men and maidens, women and children, but do not touch anyone who has the mark." The imagery of Ezekiel here, of course, has very close links with that of the book of Revelation. In Revelation 7, we find those angels of wrath not allowed to act until the servants of God have been sealed in their foreheads. Notice the criteria God instructs them to use in distinguishing those who may receive this mark of mercy. They grieve and lament, he says, over all the detestable things that are done in Jerusalem. We can't always, of course, stop the slide towards apostasy in society or even in the visible church. And God doesn't necessarily demand that we should. In totalitarian regimes, for instance, the power of government censorship and the use of police intimidation may silence all protest. And even in a democratic system where freedom of speech may be guaranteed, there's no way a few Christians can resist the paganizing majority indefinitely if that's the way society is determined to go. But what God does expect of his faithful people in days of national and moral and spiritual degeneracy is dissent, an emphatic mental repudiation
of the values and practices of a paganizing world, a refusal to be conformed. Yes, and more than dissent, a measure of disgust, too. A deeply felt sense of horror and outrage at what's going on. And a feeling of distress. A grieving and a lamenting. One can't but remember Abraham's nephew Lot, who, though he lived in depraved Sodom, we're told, had his spirit vexed, his righteous soul vexed and tormented by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. I think that last aspect of distress is particularly important. God isn't impressed, is he, by Pharisees who think they can isolate themselves from judgment by living in the smug cocoon of their own self-righteousness like prim virgins in a brothel. What God seeks are people who express their dissent and their moral outrage, not by sanctimonious prudery, but by an agonizing sorrow of heart, consciously recognizing that there is a solidarity in sin, that human beings are social creatures and cannot sever themselves from the guilt of their neighbors. Rather, he must feel ashamed and disgraced with his neighbor. So there's a warning perhaps for us in this. We shall not be judged just on the basis of whether we have personally participated in sin. We should be judged as well by how we've responded to sin in our social environment. The mark of redemption is for those who grieve about it. Another thing that's worth noting, I think, about these verses is the emotional burden which this premonition of judgment places upon the preacher. Look at verses 7 and 8 of chapter 9. Then he said to them, "Defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go." So they went out and began killing throughout the city. And while they were killing, I was left alone. I fell face down, crying out, "Ah, sovereign Lord, are you going to destroy the entire remnant of Israel in this outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem?" The way in which Ezekiel dwells on the themes of judgment, describing it in such a blood-curdling way, might lead us to think that he actually gained a kind of sadistic pleasure from the subject on occasions. I mentioned those earlier verses in which he stamps and claps his hands. Well, it is true on occasion he is given such empathy with the mind of God that he does share some sense of holy satisfaction at the punishment of the wicked. But alongside that, we have to set the witness of these verses, where the prophet tells us he was appalled at the merciless slaughter which he foresees and expresses a real sense of identification with the people this time under judgment. And surely that's a tension which every preacher must suffer. Standing between God and the people, hearing the word of God with one ear and the response of the people with the other. You can't preach judgment without praying for mercy then. Can't speak to men about God without also speaking to God about men. And if we don't feel that burden of intercession, which moves us to cry, "Our sovereign Lord," then that surely must be because, unlike Ezekiel, we have not been left alone while the killing goes on in the streets outside. Some commentators complain about the crude and bloody imagery of warrior angels with drawn swords, which Ezekiel employs here. But, of course, it's only by visualizing such a barbaric and gory scene that the reality of judgment can be brought home to us, unimaginative clods as we are, with sufficient emotional force. This is another reason for those strange dramas of Ezekiel. He's concerned that we should not just think these things cognitively, but we should feel them. I don't know if you've ever seen a massacre. I doubt whether many of us have. Some of us perhaps have served in the war, some of the more senior folk here, and know what a battlefield looks like. Others perhaps have at least watched grim scenes of such sudden death on newsreels or films. Maybe the way to bring alive a passage like this for our generation is to take those memories and to multiply them by 1,000 or 2, and then maybe we are somewhere near feeling what we ought to feel about the nightmare of hell.
It's not just a doctrine to debate about. It's a doctrine that must be felt. The plight of the lost ought to disturb us profoundly. It ought to drive us to our knees. If it doesn't, then we haven't yet seen what an awful thing it is to be lost. A third thing which emerges from these verses that's worth noting, I think, is to note the place where judgment commences in verse 6. Begin at my sanctuary, he says. So they began with the elders who were in front of the temple. When God judges the world, he does not begin with the Muslims or the Buddhists or the Hindus. He begins with the visible church. Who can abide the day of his appearing, says Malachi? Precisely because it is to the people of God that he will come first. And that brings us back to our initial question. Why do churches die? Well, we must not always be surprised if churches are dying. For the death of churches is the first sign of a society under judgment, the first sign that the glory is departing. And that brings us to this final section, the glory relocated. Look at chapter 11, verses 1 to 4. Then the Spirit lifted me up, brought me to the gate of the house of the Lord that faces east. And there at the entrance to the gate were 25 men, and I saw among them Jezaniah, son of Azur, and Pelatiah, son of Benaiah, leaders of the people. And the Lord said to me, Son of man, these are the men who are plotting evil and giving wicked advice in this city. They say, will it not soon be time to build houses? This city is a cooking pot, and we are the meat. Therefore prophesy against them. Prophesy, son of man. It's difficult to know exactly what the evil these men were plotting was precisely. The cryptic phrase in verse 3 doesn't tell us very clearly. Some people feel, as I said earlier, that they were a political pressure group advocating rebellion against Babylonia. Members of that secret 70, remember, who conspired in the temple wall. And on that reading, they're saying something like, Jerusalem is a secure city. It's never going to be conquered. Like meat in the cauldron, we're safe from the flames of Babylonian aggression because we're on the inside of this sacred city. There's a cast iron defense around us. So now is the time to make a bid for the restoration of our national prosperity and independence. Another ingenious suggestion links this crowd with the prophecy of Jeremiah. Though he's never mentioned in Ezekiel, of course Jeremiah was a senior contemporary of Ezekiel, ministering in the city of Jerusalem at this time. And sometime during the period between the first and second exiles, Jeremiah wrote an open letter to the exiles, among whom Ezekiel was numbered, Jeremiah 29, of course. And one of the things he says in that letter to the exiles is, build houses and settle down in Babylonia. So some commentators think that this group of leaders in Jerusalem are directly contradicting the advice of Jeremiah. This is not a time to build houses in Babylon, they're saying. In other words, we're not going to go into exile. We are going to overthrow Babylonia. There may be an element of truth in both those interpretations, but the evidence suggests to me a slight third variant. For verse 6, you have killed many people in this city and filled its street with the dead, does not sound to me like political activists plotting revolution. I suspect these were, in fact, just a gang of opportunist criminals, unscrupulously thinking that they could take advantage of the lawless state into which Jerusalem had fallen, with Babylonia stripping from the city the cream of its national leadership, in order to grab something for themselves. On that reading,
What they're saying is, the exiles are just the bones and the giblets. Fate has thrown them on the scrap heap. We are the real juicy meat, and we're going to get fat building houses in this city out of the wealth they've left behind. The question at issue, I think, was not so much the advisability of rebellion against Babylon, but which group of Jews was God going to bless during this period? Those who had gone into exile, or the residual population in Jerusalem? These group of men clearly represented those who felt God was still on the side of those who remained in Jerusalem. These 25 tough guys were saying, it's with us that the future lies. And Ezekiel's message is precisely to the contrary. Verse 11. This city will not be a pot for you, nor will you be the meat in it. I will execute judgment on you at the borders of Israel. A verdict which you'll see is immediately confirmed when we read in verse 13 that one of these brigands is struck dead on the spot, which I suppose is the equivalent in visionary punctuation of 5 exclamation marks. Now, not only does that interpretation make more sense of the implied criminal element in the conduct of the group in verse 6, I think it also makes more sense of verses 14 to 16, where we read, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, your brothers who are your blood relatives in the whole house of Israel, are those of whom the people of Jerusalem have said, they are far away from the Lord. This land was given to us as our possession. Therefore say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, although I sent them far away among the nations and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they've gone. This gang, who were trying to seize power in Jerusalem, took the line that God had deserted the exiles and that Jerusalem was the place where the blessings belonged. But God is saying, no, it's the exiles to whom you must look for the future of exile. No one in Jerusalem can help you now. You exiles, you must reckon your closest kin as those who are in exile with you, for they are the ones God is determined to bless. Not that lawless and corrupt gang of idolaters who think to line their pockets out of the misfortune of their exiled compatriots. Give up on Jerusalem, he's saying to them, because where God is here, in Babylonia, in this new uncongenial pagan society where we've been thrown. Believe it or not, that's where God is and where his purposes for the future lie. Hope lies with the exilic community, then, rather than in Jerusalem. And that's the theme underlying the strange movements of the Shekinah glory, which Ezekiel reports throughout these chapters 9 to 11. Just trace that with me. See, at the commencement of the judgment by slaughter in 9 verse 3, we read, the glory of the God of Israel went up from above the cherubim where it had been and moved to the threshold of the temple. It leaves then the carved cherubim on the ark and moves to the edge of the temple building, the threshold. Then at the end of the judgment by slaughter, in 10 verse 1, we read, I looked and I saw the likeness of a throne of sapphire above the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, and the Lord said to the man, go in among the wheels beneath the cherubim. Now this strange wheeled platform then, which Ezekiel saw in his initial vision, has reappeared. The mobile throne has come onto the scene again. And then after the judgment by fire, in 10 verse 18, we read the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple, stopped above the cherubim. So the glory leaves the temple threshold and wheels around. And then in verse 19, while I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground, and as they went, the wheels went with them, and they stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. So the glory moves to the door of the sanctuary area, to the east gate of the outer court. Well, the meaning of all these movements is quite clear, it seems. God is leaving the sanctuary. He's seen what's going on in the temple area, he's decided it's time to go. He goes to the door of the sanctuary, he summons his heavenly chariot, he mounts it, and he departs. My question is, of course, where's he set off for? Where is the glory of the Lord going? Well, you don't have to be very acute to discern the implied answer of that. You notice which gate he leaves by. The east gate. What lay to the east? Why, Babylon. God was going to join the exiles, as indeed Ezekiel already knew, because he'd already encountered this heavenly juggernaut, not in Jerusalem at all, but by the river Kibar, where the exiles were encamped. And if we're in any doubt about the matter, then verses 16 to 21 seem to seal the issue. When the cherubim moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the cherubim spread their wings to rise from the ground, the wheels did not leave their side, and when the cherubim stood still, they also stood still, and when the cherubim rose, they rose with them. And then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim, and while I watched, they stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was above them. Sorry, I'm reading from 10. I should be in chapter 11, verses 16 to 21, where we read in verse 22, then the cherubim with the wheels beside them spread their wings, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. And the glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. And then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the exiles in Babylon in a vision given by the Spirit of God. So Jerusalem is no longer the spiritual center of the people of God. The glory of God has been temporarily relocated in a foreign land, and Jerusalem has been abandoned. That's the message of these chapters. What are the implications of all that then for us as we think about living in a pagan land ourselves, living in a pagan land where church membership has been declining, where the influence, the public influence of Christianity has been declining for many, many years and seems to continue to do so in spite of our talk of imminent revivals? Well, I think what it means, one of the things we have to think about at any rate, is that if and when churches die as a result of God's judgment upon the spiritual declension within the visible church, it may be wise to cast our eyes around to see what new thing is happening outside the old structures of the visible church. Now, you will know that I'm far from uncritical about some of the newer groups that have arisen in the restorationist movement and the charismatic movement generally. One thing they are saying, though, that we cannot afford to neglect is that God is never tied to structures of the past. Sometimes, when the church abandons its spiritual heritage, fails to hold to the truth of the gospel, fails to preach the truth of the gospel, fails to evangelize the nation as it should, when it abandons that role which God has given to it, it may very well be that God abandons institutions of the past. God is mobile. He's not the God of places. He's the God of people. That's the message of the exile. We have no permanent title to the glory of God just because our church was founded so many hundred years ago. God is always our living contemporary. Our problem is always to keep up with what he's doing. He's always one step ahead of his church. We live in a secularized society like those exiles. It may be that what we have to learn to do is to accept that fact and adapt ourselves to the new social realities that we belong to, rather than waste our time romanticizing over the good old days. For if we do that, we may finish up losing faith in the relevance of our spiritual heritage altogether. It's certainly true that in revivals in the past, when they have come, often they have required new structures. Often those revivals were not church-based. Often they happened despite the reluctance of the established churches. It may be, too, we have to give thought to this, that God is more concerned about the spiritual caliber of his people than the visible evidence of their prosperity in the eyes of the world. And he's not above sacrificing the latter for the sake of the former. Notice in verses 17 to 18 how those verses anticipate. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. I will gather you from the nations and bring you back from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you back the land of Israel. So revival is for Israel on the agenda. They will return to it and remove all its vile images and detestable idols, and I will give them an undivided heart and put a new spirit in them, and I will remove from them their heart of stone and give them a heart of flesh, and so on. If churches die, then maybe sometimes it's for the long-term good of the church. We ought not to be sentimental sometimes about the closure of churches, that they may come when new fellowships will be rebuilt by a people more spiritually motivated than those who presided over their decline. And that maybe leads to a third thing that's worth thinking about, that the greatest need of the people of God is not church buildings or even the visible means of grace, it is spiritual vitality. I will put a new spirit in them. Then they will follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws, and they will be my people and I will be their God. Here then is a prophecy which is offered to the exile, a prophecy of a chastened and a purified people. And it points forward, doesn't it? Points forward to one who would baptize, not with water, but with the Holy Spirit and with fire. Points forward to a spiritual regeneration. One hesitates, of course, to read too much into what might seem to be an odd coincidence, but there are two little observations in this passage which are always rather tantalizing. When we read in chapter 9, verse 4, that they were to put a mark in their foreheads, some of the older commentators point out that the Hebrew letter tau, which is what that mark is in the text, in the old Hebrew script, the ancient Hebrew script, was actually a cross. So one hesitates to read too much into that, although some of the ancient commentators read a great deal into it. But it is a little tantalizing. The other thing that's a little tantalizing is in that final chapter 11, verses 22 and following, where the glory of the Lord departing hovers over the mountain east of the city. Of course, we have another name for that particular hill, don't we? We call it the Mount of Olives. There seems to be a certain wistfulness as the glory of God looks back from that mountain. 5 centuries later, of course, the glory would leave Jerusalem from that same last terminus once again. But this time, not on a throne, but tabernacled in a body of glorified humanity. And this time not in judgment, but in blessing. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world, he would say. Yes, churches may die, but the redeemed of the Lord don't have to despair when they die. God still has his purposes for his people. That's what Ezekiel had to learn. And though we must beware of short-term optimism, which short-circuits the judgment of God that has to fall on an apostate society and an apostate church, we also mustn't underestimate that God may already be sowing the seeds of something new, which he is planning to do, to restore his people, constructing perhaps a new way of being the people of God, even in an exilic situation. One of the things we should be learning from Daniel is just how the people of God were to cope practically, to survive during that exilic period. And always he holds before us the long-term hope that whether revival comes or not, the kingdom of God is not going to be defeated. God's purposes for his people are secure. Like he told disillusioned Elijah, the Lord has his remnant in Israel, and they're not going to be completely abandoned. Well, that may be something we need to take with us Some of us perhaps come from churches which are doing well. We feel encouraged. But rather more of us, I suspect, come from churches where there's more than a little discouragement, more than a little feeling that we're struggling in a society which seems very reluctant, really, to respond to the message of the gospel, and where, in spite of all this talk of imminent revival, we don't see a great deal of it in our communities. The signs of hope are there, perhaps more signs of hope than there were 10 years ago, but nothing like the kind of revival which we read about in the 18th century, or even at the beginning of this century in some parts of the British Isles. Well, for those of us who are having to wrestle with that greater measure of realism about the church in exile, maybe Ezekiel's vision of the departing glory, for all its pessimism, for all its sadness, is a vision we need to take on board. For when Ichabod is written over the structures of the past, it may very well be that God does have something up his sleeve for the future, something we need to be open to, but not naive about.